It was an accidental discovery on an unsuccessful voyage that would end in death. When Captain James Cook entered those waters at latitude 60 degrees north in May 1778, he was trying to find a northwest passage. By all reasoning, the task was hopeless, and his ship, the Resolution, was leaking badly. Later in that voyage, his third, he would die in Hawaii in a fracas with natives. It was an ironic death for one so enlightened in attitude towards native peoples. He first named the body of water Sandwich Sound after John Montague, 4th Earl of Sandwich, the British Lord of the Admiralty during the American Revolution. He also named the two major islands at its entrance, Montague and Hinchinbrook, after him. The Earl of Sandwich, a gambler who was accused of corruption during his tenure, as well as lack of naval preparedness during the Revolutionary War, became synonymous with the quick food that has become so popular. This happened when, in 1762, Montague spent 24 hours at a gaming table without other food. Later, Captain George Vancouver, who was on board the Resolution, changed the name of the water to Prince William Sound in honor of the third son of George III of England. As William IV, this monarch, known both as the Sailor King and as Silly Billy, would distinguish himself for numerous love affairs and for the 10 illegitimate children he fathered by the actress Dorothea Jordan before assuming the crown in 1830. On board the Resolution as sailing master was William Bligh, who would later be known for two famous mutinies. After the mutinies, Bligh was removed as governor of the Australian penal colony because of his unpopularity. Bligh's name would be attached to an island and a significant reef in the Sound. In spite of these inauspicious associations, the Sound remained peaceful for almost 200 years, until disrupted by the Good Friday earthquake of 1964. Valdez was rebuilt, the pipeline was erected, fisheries expanded, hatcheries proved their worth. Then disaster struck again, exactly 25 years later. Now famous the world over because of the drunken driving of a tanker captain employed by America's third richest corporation, Prince William Sound has become the subject of outrage and inquiry. Montague Island, at its entrance, is washed with toxic crude. Hinchinbrook is all that stands between devastation and the invaluable Copper River Delta. Silly Billy and his 10 illegitimate children are long since gone, as are the high-riding Captain Bligh and the undisciplined Earl of Sandwich, whose names and shadows ride over this once beautiful place. Who knows where the waterlogged bones of the Resolution came to rest? Now, new names wash over the Sound: Hazelwood, Alyeska, and Exxon. While hired hands work in futile fashion to clean rocks and beaches, these names clamp down indelibly. History and oil meet on a map that is strangely sad.
Governor, what is the latest information that you have regarding the stability of the Exxon Valdez?
Well, we think that the oil can be discharged now. It has to be done slowly, but it can be discharged without breaking up the vessel, which is what we've been afraid of ever since it went on the reef. However, the status of the ship seems to change daily, and the point at the moment is to be sure that we get that oil discharge into the Exxon Baton Rouge without disturbing its balance. It's precariously balanced on the reef. We don't want to have it roll over to one side and capsize, and we also don't want it to break in half, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding that there were some problems when they were trying to offload on Sunday, that there was some instability of the vessel and also some concern about it coming off the reef.
Yes, there was. In all these vessels, there's usually a computer system through which you can tell where you should offload without unbalancing the ship. Unfortunately, the computer system was out of whack after it hit the reef, which I suppose is understandable, but the computerized model had to be made out of Houston, so it was a little testy. It's still a little testy with that vessel, and we think that Exxon has the right formula now. That is, they can tell how to take the oil off the vessel without causing a serious imbalance.
You have declared this an emergency disaster area.
I sure have. It is a disaster.
What does that do? Does that free up immediately some state funds?
Well, it does in case we need it. It's also a signal. It's more of a statement than it is an important thing from a functional standpoint. We're also going to ask for a declaration of a federal emergency. As it turns out, I'm going to be speaking with President Bush on Saturday in any event in Washington, and I certainly am going to bring up this subject. As a practical matter, the declaration of state and federal disasters probably won't mean that anything is done differently. It may mean that there is a different configuration in terms of who pays immediately. I say immediately because it's clear that Exxon is going to have to foot the bill sooner or later.
The latest estimate by the Coast Guard I heard is that the oil spill is 10 by 10, 100 square miles. Is that your information?
That's pretty close. It is. When I looked at it last, it was only, and I put that in quotes, about 32 square miles. And of course, it continues to spread with time. So 100 square miles is about right.
What is your latest information from Commissioner Kelso? Has much of it or any of it reached shore?
At the moment, no, because we've been blessed with calm water there. It's a mixed blessing, however, because when you have calm water, you cannot use dispersants effectively. Dispersants are the chemicals that are dropped on the oil. The effect of the chemical is to break up the oil into much smaller pieces and then drop the oil to the ocean floor. The downside to the use of dispersants is that they are highly toxic to marine life, and so they need to be used in a very selective way. At the moment, what we need to do, number one, is to make sure that more oil isn't spilled. There was, the last time I talked to Valdez, about 900,000 barrels still on board the Exxon Valdez. Secondly, we have to utilize mechanical means to pick up as much oil as we possibly can while we still have the calm weather. And by the way, that may have changed during the night. And then third, we have to be very careful to try to clean up some of the selected areas that are most sensitive in terms of the wildlife as well as the fish runs. We can't get it all now, but we'd like to boom off those areas that are sensitive for reasons of the herring run or where we know there are large concentrations of salmon fry and salmon smolt. So we're going to try to do that. The effort will be limited because we simply don't have the equipment to clean up all 100 square miles. We just don't have it.
I understand also that some DEC officials and some local fishermen are planning to get out in boats at first light this morning, lay down some booms along sensitive areas. What is Exxon doing at this time?
Well, I can't speak for Exxon. I authorized Denny Kelso, the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, simply to take whatever steps he thought were necessary to clean it up. We thought the original response by Alyeska was slow and that it was inadequate. And Exxon has a right, really, to take charge of this cleanup. But frankly, we thought that action was pretty slow. And we have a state responsibility as well, which we've assumed. We need to work together with Exxon. We don't want two or three different operations going on which are uncoordinated. So it's enormously important that we we're able to work together. Now, I assume that we will be able to do this with Exxon. Exxon and Denny Kelso had a number of meetings last night, which I understand resulted in an agreement for a coordinated effort. But frankly, I want every piece of equipment mobilized here. I don't want to see any equipment sitting in port and people arguing about whose responsibility it is or who's going to pay for it. We can sort that out later. This will be a lawyer's paradise for another 10 or 15 years. In the meantime, we want every available piece of equipment out there cleaning up this spill.
What is your understanding of marine life that has been affected already?
Well, it's been reported to me that there are some ducks and other marine birds that are in the oil. Some few have been picked up by the Coast Guard, and I was told that there were killer whales in the oil as well. I only got the one report of that. There are some sea otters in there. It's unlikely that any of those animals will survive. But at the moment, if you had to have this kind of spill, and of course we didn't, but since it happened, it's probably better that it happened now than at certain other times of the year. Although, if we have to use dispersants in a big way, it's going to hurt the small salmon, the juvenile salmon that are in Prince William Sound. There's no question about it. So there's no way of getting out of this without major damage to the wildlife and to the marine ecosystem. You can't get out of it without some damage. What we have to do now is to minimize it and to try to keep the toxicity levels when we use dispersants to a bare minimum. We have to be very selective about that.
An absorbent material that's called oil snare, mm-hmm. I think, is coming up from the lower 48, and that might be dropped on it and mm-hmm. would separate the thick crude into patches, and then that could be burned. Is that?
We hope that'll work, yeah, because the light oil will evaporate over time. The heavy crude, you have to get it either to the bottom or you have to collect it by mechanical means. We hope that will work. We want to mobilize every single every kind of methodology that we can to do the necessary here. It will probably require several different ways of collecting the oil. We want to use everything that we can, and we want to do it intelligently and coordinate the effort. Otherwise, the damage will be more extensive than it needs to be.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think I'll be a little more philosophical later on about what this means to Alaska. It's certainly not going to help the ANWR effort. That's for certain. At the moment, however, my attention is pretty much on cleaning up the oil spill and what we have to do to coordinate this effort and to bring every single asset we have to bear on this oil spill.
Our view is that if the fish, these young fish, are at a very sensitive life stage, and if they come into contact with oil or eat plankton that are contaminated with oil, that it will likely that there will be immediate killing of fish and then a chronic problem, which will mean that the fish will probably not be able to survive through adulthood. So those are the two things that we see happening to the salmon. In addition, there are 900 anadromous fish streams in Prince William Sound. At this point, the oil does not cover the beaches or the bays or the estuary in front of that many of these streams, but if it does go onshore to the west side of Prince William Sound, it will hit a lot of them, including some pretty important ones. So there is a lot of impact that may still be happening here, which we have not seen.
How about other marine life in the Sound?
I'll be happy to talk about that. The first one is herring. The herring fishery, we anticipate the resource, the biomass into Prince William Sound this year at 110 million pounds. That means that the fishery would be able to harvest approximately 14 to 16 million pounds. Two of the spawning areas, we have split up Prince William Sound into four areas for purposes of our analysis. Two of these spawning areas, Naked Island and Montague, have been oiled. So we're concerned about what would happen if the herring actually spawned in these areas, or if they were displaced from the areas and tried to spawn somewhere else, whether there would be any survival. So that will go into, so we're very concerned about the herring eggs, and the fishery that may be conducted, and we'll be making decisions on the fisheries as pretty soon, as early as this weekend, on some of the fisheries as it goes through the spawning period.
Isn't there a long-line black cod fishery scheduled to open in the next couple of days?
There were two fisheries that we have closed. We closed the pot shrimp fishery, and that it will be closed effective April 3rd. It has been going on since March 15th. There was also to be a black cod, which is also a sablefish fishery, that was to open on April 1st, and that has now been closed. Mainly our concern is oiling of equipment and potentially oiling of the fish as they are pulled through the water column.
How does it look for the herring fishery?
It's really iffy at this point. We're not sure.
Okay. The condition, though, of other marine mammals in Prince William Sound, we've heard reports that some killer whales have been sighted in the oil slick, also that there are several substantial sea otter colonies in Prince William Sound. Can you give us an update on that?
I can. The marine mammals that we see as having the most likely impact are sea otters and sea lions. There have been reported hundreds of sea otters oiled at this time, and that virtually means death for those sea otters. Sea lion rookeries are important, haul-out areas. Some of them have been affected. Some of the major ones have not yet been, and we're still waiting to see what's going to happen with the sea lions. In addition, we're going to be seeing in the next couple of weeks actually even maybe sooner than that, California gray whales and humpback whales coming into the area. There's groups of them which normally feed in Prince William Sound, and some of the area in which they feed is in Night Passage, which has been oiled.
What is the status of the oil spread right now? How far south, how far into Cook Inlet has it gone?
Oil is now extending down essentially the full length of Shelikov Strait near Kodiak, and it is also extending in both the mouth of Cook Inlet and into Kamishak Bay. There was a light oiling in the Port Graham area. So far, Kachemak Bay itself is still clean, but barely.
For 5 weeks now, we've seen on television pictures of men and women scrubbing rocks. And is there any technology available today that could help in this cleanup, or that could really clean up Prince William Sound, or is it just a matter of time and nature?
That's a tough question, because the areas to be cleaned up differ in their characteristics. Some areas are bare rock faces. Others are rich intertidal areas with lots of organisms, or at least there used to be lots of organisms there before the contact with the oil. Some have been lightly oiled, some heavily oiled. Some, those organisms have been really damaged by the oil. In others, the oiling was light enough that they still have a chance of surviving. In the last day or so, we have been working with Admiral Robbins of the Coast Guard, and Admiral Robbins has requested that the temperature of the water be increased in areas where there's already so much biological damage that it's unlikely to do additional damage to use heat. And for example, the temperature of water being used right now in those beaches that have been so hard hit that you're not doing more damage mm-hmm. is about 160 degrees, and that does seem to move more of the oil off the rocks, and in fact, some of it seems to be fairly effective. But of course, if you use water temperatures like that on beaches that still have organisms, it's going to take care of the oil,
everything.
But it will destroy the organisms at the same time. Both the Coast Guard and the Department of Environmental Conservation are asking Exxon to be more exhaustive in the evaluation of cleanup methods. We're going out and evaluating methods ourselves, and we're identifying those that seem to have promise, and then we're asking Exxon to give them specific consideration.
Robbins said that oil is still leaking from the Exxon Valdez. What do you know about that?
On Thursday, I flew over the tanker and observed a small slick inside the boom and a larger slick outside the boom. The boom surrounds the tanker. Admiral Robbins believes that oil on the walls of the cargo holds is coming off into the water within those holes. Now they are largely empty of oil, but not entirely, and that's the oil that is coming from the vessel. We have requested further information. Exxon has told us that we will be able to get a briefing here in the next couple of days, so we're watching that very closely.
Have you had any word from Exxon on when they plan to move the tanker, how soon they think it will be ready to move?
That's a good question, and one that we have raised repeatedly. Originally, Exxon had indicated they would be out of here by now, but they, as of Thursday evening, were indicating that it might be around another 2 weeks or so. Admiral Robbins believes that it's going to be substantially longer than that, and we tend to believe that Admiral Robbins' assessment is correct.
What about reports that fishermen are pulling in dead bottom fish, that some people are even saying that they believe oil is even though it's lighter than water, it's something's getting to those rockfish and killing them. What's your understanding of that?
We are getting reports not only of dead fish, but also of oil being found on anchor chains and anchors that are lowered through what appears to be clean water. And we're taking those reports seriously. In theory, there should not be much opportunity for oil, which should be lighter than the water, to be found at depth. But there are some circumstances under which that does occur, and so we are taking these reports seriously. What we need is some actual samples to show what we have. Some of the experts have indicated that it's virtually impossible for this oil to be carried at depth in the water, but it also was virtually impossible, so they said, for the tanker to be way out of the tanker lanes and to have this kind of accident on a well-marked reef. So we're taking all of these reports seriously. The rule that I've been following is, rather than rely on the theory, let's go look. Let's see what we find there. And to me, the reports coming from experienced fishermen, people who know the sound, that there's something under the water, need to be taken quite seriously.
What do your people, what do the scientists and the biologists and the fish and game folks that have been up there, are they giving you any estimate of how long they think it will take the sound to recover? And will it ever recover?
It's too early to tell. I would have to say that the areas that I have been on the ground where heavy oiling has taken place are going to take a very long time to restore. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything we can, and we expect Exxon to pull out all the stops and do everything possible to reduce the impact of the oil. But this is an area that had virtually no impact at all from human activity prior to this. So what we are looking at now is a change in productivity, a change in environmental conditions that is really unprecedented, and we're going to have to watch very closely to see how it progresses. No one knows the answer at this point.
I'll be driving. I can't tell me.
The last part of what Captain Hazelwood says on that part of the tape is unintelligible, but the Coast Guard radar operator on duty comes back on to check the ship's stated position.
6-5 Valdez, it's Valdez traffic, roger. Are you just about a mile north of Blair's?
But the tanker was aground on Bligh Reef, and the Anchorage Daily News reports that Hazelwood's first statement of his ship's position is one of several areas under investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. 15 minutes after that first call, the Coast Guard closed the port of Valdez to tanker traffic. Within a half an hour, the captain of the port, Commander Steve McCall, was talking to Hazelwood. Hazelwood here makes a reference to some problem with the third mate, but doesn't elaborate, and the conversation continues.
Congressman George Miller from California, and I represent the 7th District, and I'm in Juneau, Alaska.
How long have you been up in Prince William Sound?
I was up for 3 days.
Okay. All right. Can I get this a little bit
That's right, or two days. 2 days or 3 days.
Okay. What did you do when you were up there?
Spent a considerable amount of time, one, overflying the spill, meeting with some of the subsistence individuals in the Sawmill Harbor Bay, I guess, and talking to the fishermen who were working there to defend the fisheries. Went over to Cordova, met with the fishermen, with the mayor of the city, some of the business people, and people who are concerned about what the impact's going to be on their economy.
And what impression do you have walking away from this?
That you've got a major ecological disaster that's absolutely out of control, and with very little likelihood that you're going to bring it back into control, because the time that has passed, the 15 days, with such a confused and unacceptable effort, probably now means that you're not going to have any major extraction of oil from the waters.
President Bush this morning announced that he would be sending additional federal assistance. You said you haven't touched base with Washington yet, so you're not sure exactly what that means. But have you been one who has favored some kind of federal intervention in this?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, I think it became clear the first 24 hours that you did not have the capacity in Southeast Alaska, in Prince William Sound, to deal with the magnitude of the spill and with the hazard that it posed. And I think the governor was right. This thing should have been federal. In the ensuing time, that Exxon really had no plan to coordinated effort to deal with this spill. And really, when you travel around the spill, what you see is that the major defensive effort is being led by volunteer fishermen who've just taken their boats and responded and using the booms and what have you that that have been provided to them by Exxon and by others and that they've purchased on their own to try to defend the hatcheries and some of the most sensitive environmental areas.
Any sense of, in what you've seen and what you've heard from Exxon, I assume you spoke with some Exxon officials when you were up there.
No, I missed that opportunity.
Any sense of Exxon's liability in this in light of the congressional, in light of that measure which limits liability of companies to $100 million, I believe?
The TAPS fund. Well, it depends. You know, there are exceptions to that in various cases of negligence, what have you. Obviously, other people can sue them. I think that's all really to be sorted out later. The tragedy is that much of the liability could have been avoided had they been prepared for this spill and had they drilled people and had they built up an expertise over the past 15 years while they've had a safe record to deal with this day. But obviously some complacency, some arrogance, some flexing of political muscle have allowed them to really dramatically diminish the contract they had with the people of Alaska, certainly, and I think the people of the United States, about their abilities to deal with a major oil spill in Prince William Sound, something that they said would never happen, but unfortunately happened.
What are you going to do when you go back to Washington?
Well, I hope to be able to convince our committee and my colleagues in the Congress that this disaster was we were totally unprepared for it. That the technology and plans to handle this kind of disaster exist elsewhere in the world. I think it's ironic that the governor has to ask the Soviets, and I guess the Soviets are going to respond positively, that they had people from Norway fly in to tell us how you could manage a spill this size in a matter of maybe 24 to 48 hours, except that we don't have any of that kind of equipment available in Alaska or in the San Francisco Bay Area or Long Beach where you could have this kind of spill. And I think what we've got to say is that the lesson to be learned from this is that we've got to be very strict, that you can't, you've got to do it on a first-class basis. And I'm afraid that that here we've seen over the years the oil companies continue to try to save a few thousand dollars, a few hundred thousand dollars, a few million dollars here, and of course now they've created what may be in excess of $100 million catastrophe.
What realistically do you think this, what effect do you think this will have on current legislation to open up ANWR?
I think it's dramatically reduced the chances for that legislation. But I think it also calls into question the absolute need to re-examine the system. This is an entire system from the Arctic Circle to Long Beach, California, and a major component of that system just broke down. And it's sort of like the Challenger shuttle. Because there was nothing wrong with the passengers, didn't mean that we then took another group of passengers and put them on another shuttle. We examined it from top to bottom, and of course it turned out, you know, it wasn't just the O-rings that went wrong on the shuttle. It turned out that there were thousands of defects that had been overlooked and corners that had been cut. And I think that if we're going to continue to rely on Alaska for 25% of our petroleum imports into the lower 48, we have a real obligation to re-examine this system. It's now 15, 20 years old. And a lot of corners have been cut. A lot of political muscle has been exercised in the state of Alaska and the Congress of the United States to cut these corners. And I think we better go back to square one. You know, you used to have two tugs. He used to have only daytime passage. He used to have all kinds of safety regulations. He used to have a dedicated 24-hour response team. You didn't have any of those the night of the accident. And I think the people of Alaska probably want to know why. And I think the people of America will want to know why. And the real why is that a lot of legislators couldn't stand up to the oil industry, and maybe the Coast Guard couldn't stand up to the oil industry or to Alyeska. And as a result of that, the system that many of us were convinced had the, you know, was worth more than the paper was written on, turned out not to, it turned out to be a hollow promise. It turned out to be a fraud. And that's a very serious state of affairs. And ANWR is all a part of that.
Okay. As you know, Senator Murkowski has done an about-face on Bristol Bay leasing. And I know that you're very concerned about possible lease sales off the coast of California. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think that the whether it's Bristol Bay or the Chukchi Sea or off the coast of the Arctic plain, we're getting into riskier and riskier endeavors to find oil. What would you have done if this tanker had broken open in Bristol Bay in a storm? What would you have done if this tanker broke open in the ice flows of the Chukchi Sea? I mean, I think those, you know, but we're constantly given assurances that that this will never happen. We're constantly given assurances that technology can handle all of this, that the industry will use the state-of-the-art technology. Of course, what we just found out was they didn't do that. They preferred to save the money. So I think this is one of those events that comes along in society, that comes along in political history, that demands a complete re-examination. When Three Mile Island went down, we re-examined every other nuclear power plant in this country. When Chernobyl went down, the Soviets re-examined every other nuclear power plant in the Soviet Union. When the Challenger went down, we re-examined all of the other space shuttles, and we redesigned them. This is on the magnitude of that. This is the largest oil spill in the history of this country, among one of the largest in the world. And you know, the oil industry plans to continue to take oil through Prince William Sound, down the what can sometimes be the violent coast of California, and the Northwest for the next 30 years or 40 years. I think we ought to find out whether or not they really have the capability to do that. They've had a remarkable record in Prince William Sound, but the one day, you know, the one time it happened, the record wasn't worth anything. It didn't mean anything.
Going back for just a minute, you made an analogy earlier about the system failed, and that we have to go back and examine, as you were saying, the components of that. Does that cast any opinion of yours on the inevitable opening of ANWR to oil and gas exploration?
Well, I certainly wouldn't open it under these conditions.
I realize that, but down the line, do you think that is inevitable? Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't know that yet. I'm going to have some meetings this weekend with, and maybe have more to say about that, you know, next week or so.
Okay. All right. Touching just briefly on the Tongass, what do you think is going to happen in the Congress with the current legislation?
I think that the Mrazek bill will pass in the Interior Committee within the next couple of weeks. I think it'll pass overwhelmingly on the floor of the House. I understand the Senate committee is coming out to hold field hearings in Southeast, I guess, in Sitka and in Ketchikan. I would expect that committee will also favorably report out a similar type of bill, and that unlike last year, that bill will probably pass the Senate, and we will end up in conference, and we will eventually send something to the President's desk before the end of the Congress.
Are you comfortable with all of the provisions and the way the Mrazek's bill is currently written?
For the most part, sure. I mean, there'll be some small changes, but I think that it's a fair balance between all of the economic interests in Southeast Alaska and the environment. I think it It gives a nod that should be given to new growth industries, the fisheries, tourism, recreation, by reining in some of the practices of the pulp companies and some of the forest practices, and clearly sets aside some very unique assets in the world and certainly in this region. So yeah, I, for the most part, I'm very comfortable with it.
Good. Anything else you want to say about Prince William Sound?
Mm.
This is a special news update on the oil spill in Valdez. I'm Sumner McLeish. Fishermen are fearful of an ecological disaster in Prince William Sound. Exxon is having problems organizing cleanup efforts and removing the remaining million barrels of oil from the supertanker Exxon Valdez. This morning, the tanker Baton Rouge began offloading some of that oil from the grounded supertanker, but so much oil spilled out of the supertanker that officials stopped the process immediately. Claire Richardson has more from Valdez.
Coast Guard Lieutenant Tripp Rice says the hull of the ship sustained massive damage when it grounded early Friday morning.
Right now, in the opinion of the naval architect who designed the vessel, with the amount of damage that was described to him, the vessel cannot be floated right now in the condition it's in. So there's going to have, when the vessel is floated, it will be after there is some significant patchwork that is done to either all or at least some of the major tanks on board.
A boom has been placed around the tanker, and the transferring of oil has been delayed. A C-130 plane from Florida is standing by in Anchorage, and Exxon wants to use the plane to drop chemical dispersant onto the slick. At a news conference this afternoon, Exxon President Frank Iorosi said he hopes to have better luck than yesterday when calm water stopped the dispersant from breaking up the spill.
So we need to test with the larger droplets to see the effectiveness of that spray. And that'll tell us whether we could depend primarily on dispersants or mechanical pickup.
How did the hiccup test work?
It was marginal.
The people who depend on the resource-rich waters of Prince William Sound are concerned about the effects of dispersants on fish and are angry at the long delay in cleanup. Ray Cesarini owns Seahawk Seafoods in Valdez.
I'm really still concerned as why nobody bothered to try to clean up the oil before it got to the size that it got to. No booning of the ship. And I'm concerned about this disbursement method because that does get into the marine environment in the ocean. It can affect not just bottom fish, it can affect the plankton. You know, we've got, like I said before, hundreds of millions of fry swimming out of streams right now that eat that plankton. And if they eat it, I'm thoroughly convinced they'll die.
The state is also angry at the slowness of Alyeska pipeline officials. The commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation is Dennis Kelso. He says his department has begun an investigation.
A team looking at the overall legal alternatives that are available. And I don't mean by that to suggest that we're focusing on Alyeska, but we have clearly have a written oil spill contingency plan and some legal expectations there. We have a statute to back us up. But we are going to be looking at the overall situation, and we're going to make sure that when the time comes, I have the information to make a call, and I certainly will.
Whose fault is this? Who did fault you see this as being, or is it a combination?
Well, I don't have the information to be able to say who was at fault. And frankly, that's a legitimate and important thing to resolve. But right now, my greatest concern is keeping any more oil from going into the Sound and doing whatever can be done to maximize recovery from this point. So I don't mean to just sidestep that question. If you look at the facts, it's one of those things where you have to say, well, something serious went wrong here. And so far, we haven't heard an adequate explanation. No mechanical problems. Sea conditions were good. The vessel was outside the traffic lanes. I don't know what that all means.
DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso speaking with reporter Claire Richardson in Valdez. Kelso says Alyeska is supposed to have had a five-hour response time to any oil spill, but it reportedly took more than 14 hours for any oil containment equipment to reach the area, some 25 miles south of the port of Valdez where the supertanker was grounded. Even if the response from Alyeska had been quicker, it may not have made that much difference, according to Alyeska spokesman Chuck O'Donnell.
100,000 barrels, which was reported to us, everything that we had out there at that point in time would not have really made all that much of a difference, just, again, because of the magnitude of it. It was going to take additional resources. That we were assured of, and those are a lot of the processes we began working on immediately through the help of both the Valdez resources and our resources out of our Anchorage office.
Governor Steve Cooper is back in Juneau today after spending most of Friday afternoon and evening in Valdez. Characterizing the oil spill as a nightmare come true, the governor said this afternoon that Alyeska Pipeline's initial response to the situation was clearly unacceptable.
I think Alyeska's response was slow and inadequate, and it's particularly ironic that it comes at a time when Alyeska was arguing that its methodology was perfectly sound. It was engaging in an ongoing argument with the Department of Environmental Conservation that everything was okay in case this kind of situation came up. I guess we have the answer to that question.
Cooper says the spill is one of the biggest disasters in Alaska history. Like the fishermen in Valdez, Cooper says he's concerned over the potential toxicity of using chemical dispersants to sink the oil slick, but right now the governor says he sees no alternative.
Well, the dispersing agents are the only practical way to send this crude to the bottom, broken up into much smaller pieces so that it can be absorbed over time. The liability is that the use of dispersants will be toxic to marine life. It will have a very deleterious effect on the marine ecosystem. We hope it'll be temporary. In a way, we're lucky in that sense, the salmon runs have not arrived yet. There is a herring run there, but the salmon haven't arrived yet. And if we can get these dispersants out and the crude broken up and down to the bottom, it shouldn't have a major effect on marine life, we hope. That's about as good as it gets.
Governor Steve Cooper speaking in Juneau this afternoon. At this hour, Exxon is holding another press conference in Valdez. KTOO-FM News will keep you posted through the weekend as events unfold in Prince William Sound. I'm Sumner McLeish.
Yeah, that's the correct color. Do you have any more of an estimate as to your situation at this time, over?
Not at the present.
Julian went here. That was the third mate, but we're working our way on the reef. The vessel has been hauled. We're ascertaining right now. We're trying to get her off the reef, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Over.
Roger on that.
Officials are trying to contain a major oil spill in central Alaska. Over 100,000 gallons of North Slope crude oil spilled into the port of Valdez last night after a tanker ran aground. Sumner McLeish of member station KTOO reports.
The oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran hard aground about 25 miles south of the port of Valdez shortly after midnight last night. Oil began leaking from the vessel, and the Coast Guard estimates some 150,000 gallons of North Slope crude have now spilled into the water. The tanker is holding 1.2 million gallons of oil, and Coast Guard officials are categorizing the spill as a major accident. The port of Valdez, the southern end of the Alaska pipeline, has been closed to all tanker traffic. Officials do not yet know whether oil is still leaking into port waters at this time. For National Public Radio, this is Sumner McLeish in Juneau, Alaska.
The supertanker Exxon Valdez had just picked up 200 million liters of North Slope crude oil from the southern end of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Shortly after midnight, the tanker pulled through a narrow channel about 40 kilometers south of Port Valdez and ran aground hard on a reef, gashing holes in its hull and spilling oil from five holding tanks. Coast Guard officials were on the scene within an hour and by early Friday morning had determined it was a significant enough spill to call in a special oil strike force from California. At this hour, the amount of oil leaked from the supertanker is estimated at 40 million liters. The Coast Guard's Chris Haley says so far no oil has hit any shoreline, but he says it's still touch and go as to whether the huge oil slick will be pushed out to sea or back towards Valdez Sound.
They've almost made it out of the channel, and depending on the weather and the tide, will dictate where the oil is going to go from there, whether it goes back up the channel or whether it goes out into the Gulf.
The oil currently stretches in a swath, measuring 8 kilometers long by about 1 kilometer wide, but Haley says the flow from the tanker has slowed.
It is still leaking, but it's down to a trickle. And they have got some containment and cleanup equipment on scene, and they're deploying that at this time.
The governor of Alaska, Steve Cooper, is on the scene now and is expected to fly over the oil spill within the next few hours to determine the extent of the disaster. This is the largest oil spill on record in Alaska waters. For CBC News, this is Sumner McLeish in Juneau, Alaska.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Oil containment teams and equipment from across the U.S. and as far away as London are on their way to Valdez, Alaska, to help deal with the worst oil spill in U.S. history. A supertanker has leaked more than 11 million gallons of North Slope crude into Prince William Sound. The focus now is on how to contain an oil slick measuring 32 square miles. Summer McLeish of member station KPOO reports.
Officials have spent the night in Valdez considering the options they have to try to prevent further damage from the huge oil spill. Already, some marine mammals have been caught in the thick crude oil, and the sound is full of sensitive sea otter and sea lion rookeries and other hatcheries. The governor of Alaska, Steve Cooper, spent several hours on the supertanker Exxon Valdez on Friday and said it will take considerable work to contain the huge oil spill.
I think everybody's responded well. We're doing everything we can, but this is the largest oil spill in the history of Alaska and one of the biggest oil spills in history, period. So we're going to be on the job there for quite a while.
While oil containment booms are in the water near the scene of the grounded supertanker, officials are now considering whether to use chemicals to disperse the oil. Testing is expected to begin at first light this morning. For National Public Radio, this is Sumner McLeish in Juneau, Alaska.
According to From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Officials in Valdez, Alaska are evaluating their options in Prince William Sound, the site of the largest oil spill in U.S. history. Millions of gallons of crude oil leaked from the supertanker Exxon Valdez after it ran aground yesterday. Some of the oil has come ashore in the biologically sensitive area. Sumner McLeish of member station KTOO reports.
Sea otters, sea lions, and ducks have now been sighted in the massive oil spill, and there is considerable concern over the best means to prevent further ecological damage in Prince William Sound. Denny Kelso, commissioner of Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, is in Valdez and says wherever possible, mechanical methods, such as oil containment booms and skimmers, will be used to prevent the spill from spreading.
Right now, we're looking closely at what can be done to protect the most sensitive habitat areas, but this is a very large spill, and there are a large number of important habitat areas in the area. This is a sensitive part of Alaska's marine environment, and you can't imagine a much worse place to have this kind of event happen.
The Port of Valdez has been closed to all tanker traffic, and the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company has reduced the flow in the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline to 800,000 barrels daily. That's down from 1.2 million barrels a day. For National Public Radio, this is Sumner McLeish in Juneau, Alaska.
Officials in Valdez, Alaska are still evaluating their options for containing the largest oil spill in U.S. history. Thick North Slope crude oil now covers a 32-square-mile area after more than 11 million gallons leaked into the biologically sensitive region. Sumner McLeish from KTOO has this update. Sea otters, sea lions, and ducks have now been sighted in the massive oil spill, and there is considerable concern over the best means to prevent further ecological damage in Prince William Sound. Denny Kelso, commissioner of Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, is in Valdez, and he says wherever possible, mechanical methods, such as oil containment booms and skimmers, will be used to prevent the spill from spreading.
Right now, we're looking closely at what can be done to protect the most sensitive habitat areas. But this is a very large spill, and there are a large number of important habitat areas in the area. This is a sensitive part of Alaska's marine environment, and you can't imagine a much worse place to have this kind of event happen.
And Alaska's chief environmental official says he is very concerned with the way the oil spill has been handled so far.
Well, quite frankly, we are not happy with the initial response by the responsible party. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company has a oil spill contingency plan, which they are obligated to implement. We've not been happy with the way that was carried out, and we are looking into the reasons for that.
Kelso says the oil spill should have never been allowed to become so large. Meanwhile, an oil tanker is standing by the grounded supertanker, ready to offload the remaining North Slope crude oil. For CBC News, this is Sumner McLeish in Juneau, Alaska.